Welcome to Legal Talk, a monthly conversation about the American legal system with Minnesota Supreme Court Associate Justice Gordon Moore.
Well, happy Monday
95.1.
I was set up. I was let down. You know, Gordon, I actually thought for sure I had a stop built into there.
I thought we had a new addition to the bumper music, Rich, that you added from last time.
Oh, well, let's try that again. Happy Monday morning, everybody. My name is Rich Larson, and I'm sitting with State Supreme Court Justice Gordon Moore, who had nothing to do with the production of this radio show. Good morning, sir. How are
morning,
you?
Morning, Rich. You're doing well. Happy Mother's Day to all out there.
Indeed.
Celebrate.
Indeed. Happy Mother's Day to anyone who is doing any sort of mothering at all.
Yes.
You guys, how you been doing at the Supreme Court this month? Feels like there hasn't been a whole lot coming out, at least, at the Supreme
Well,
Court.
May was a light month in terms of cases that we actually heard. The highlight of May was our high school case on May 2nd.
Yeah.
We traveled to Richfield High School to hear oral arguments on Cruz Guzman versus State, which is the continuation of the lawsuit that originated in Hennepin County attacking the adequacy of publicly funded education in Minnesota under a provision from the state constitution called the Education Clause. That provision states this, and I'll just quote it. It says, "The stability of a Republican form of government, depending mainly upon the intelligence of the people, it is the duty of the legislature to establish a general and uniform system of public schools. The legislature shall make such provisions by taxation or otherwise as will secure a thorough and efficient system of public schools through the state." And so the question in this case, Rich, is whether whether the existence of segregation in a public school district is by itself evidence of an inadequate education and therefore a violation of the uniform system of public schools requirement in the state constitution. In 1995, in a case called Skeen versus State of Minnesota, there was an attack on the funding of public education, the property tax-based and, you know, the sort of the frankly, disparities that exist district to district. And in 1995, the court found that the education clause to the state constitution guarantees an adequate education, but it did not require a education that was identical district to district, and the funding provisions of the state law were upheld. Mm-hmm. This focuses more on the outcomes of education and whether schools, you know, are educating children, and whether in particular segregated schools in Minneapolis and St. Paul are meeting the requirements of the education clause. So that was the overview. We heard that case before the student body at Richfield High School on May 2nd. I think I can speak for my colleagues. Overall, it was a great day.
Sure.
Students, well, first of all, the Richfield School District welcomed us with open arms. Some of the best planning that I've seen for one of these events. Everything was really thought through carefully, and they really wanted us to be there, and that showed.
That's fantastic.
From the way their principal and their superintendent embraced us, and the students, every justice got three students to basically be guides during the day. And it was just wonderful. These young people are, you know, not to be too cliched about this, but it gives you a little bit of faith in the future when you're around people that, you know, are so energetic, lifelike, and question after question. I mean, it was when we weren't on the stage, it was just, you know, it was an ongoing barrage of really good questions.
That was what I wanted to know, is how did the students respond to this, and what were there good questions?
Great questions. Yeah. Great questions, both in the audience of the high school.
Mm-hmm.
In front of the whole court, lots of questions on how people become lawyers, how they become, you know, justices, judges. And then just in our smaller group sessions, justices had the option of going to classrooms.
Yeah.
And I took that opportunity, and it was really interesting to hear what perspective students had. Obviously, we weren't talking about the case.
Yeah.
We weren't going to, you know, kind of, you know, debrief on that. But the questions of segregation, you know, what it was referred to as mass incarceration, questions relating to fairness and equity generally in education, you know, and we talked about open enrollment, you know, our state laws are give a pretty liberal degree of parent and student choice, which I think we view as a positive in this state, but along with that has some consequences.
There are some consequences.
And I know that our local school district has arguably benefited from some of that open enrollment, but I was on the school board of a school district in Southwest Minnesota, Worthington, that frankly was keeping local small town schools alive by open enrollment out of the Worthington School District. You can, that's a whole nother debate. What was another interesting wrinkle to this is charter schools intervened on the side of the state in this case. So we had three parties arguing.
Okay.
And the charter schools are, you know, formed by parent choice, obviously. Mm-hmm. And some of them are, I guess you could characterize them as segregated. They are very racially, some of them are very racially focused.
Yes.
And their some of their outcomes are just outstanding too. I mean, in terms of, you know, what they're doing there. And so it's hard to generalize. I can just tell you that this is a incredibly challenging case. It's been around for a while. The parties tried to settle it. There was a bill that was put forward to the legislature that would have ended the litigation and created some things that I don't want to get into that I don't think it ever actually got a floor vote. It was kind of dead on arrival from what I heard. And so the litigation continues and it's been going on for quite a while. But it's so much fun to be back in the roadshow territory.
Yeah.
And the court is going to be resuming its outstate roadshows in the fall.
Fantastic.
Traditionally, I think this was the 52nd argument we had, Rich, since 1995 that the court has gone to a high school.
Since 95?
Yeah, Justice Keith, Sandy Keith from Rochester, initiated this in 1995 when he was Chief Justice. And so traditionally, it's been outstate fall, metro spring to sort of focus on weather. And we're going to get back to that. We haven't been outstate since 2019.
Right,
so we're going, it looks like, to the 8th Judicial District in the fall. Specifics to be determined, but that's Western Minnesota.
Okay.
In the, you know, Litchfield, Wilmer, Morris, Montevideo, Granite Falls area of the state. So, significantly smaller school districts than Richfield or Shakopee, where we were last fall.
Is Worthington in that district?
No. Okay. Worthington's south of that in the 5th, but the makeup is quite similar. The court was actually in Worthington in 2014
when
I was down there on the bench. I was part of the planning committee for that, and the Worthington is one of these old school gymnasiums that has been around since the 50s and is a great place for like section basketball tournaments, and that place was packed.
That's great.
And a lot of those small school districts around Worthington were invited to bring kids in too, so it was a great experience.
That's fantastic.
So yeah, that's coming up next year, and then we'll be in the spring of 24 going to one of our metro area districts. It probably will be the 10th or 2nd district, so either the St. Paul area or north suburbs. So it's to be determined.
Well, the great part about this program, notwithstanding the fact that you're actually doing it in the first place, but to see the enthusiasm from someone like you who's sitting on the bench about doing this. I mean, this isn't something the state is imposing upon you. Like, okay, you got to go sit with the kids. You're excited, genuinely excited about getting out and talking to the kids about this.
Oh,
stuff.
It's. I think they're among the best days we have.
That's great.
You know, and I really miss that interaction with the public that I had in the district court. Mm-hmm. Now, granted, some of that interaction was not always terribly positive in the courtroom, but I really enjoyed my work. In juvenile law in district court. And some of it was in really, really frustrating. I mean, reaching juveniles within your own family can be challenging, much less reaching kids, you know, in some other person's family. But it's so reaffirming to see kids that care and are on the right track.
Right.
And, you know, the Richfield's diversity is just amazing. You know, I lived in South Minneapolis in the late 80s, and the changes in Richfield from then to now, it's demographically very similar to Worthington. It's 70-80%, you know, sort of, you know, diverse. And so, and those kids embrace that, and they, you know, nobody talked about it. It's just the way it is, and people are fine with that. And so, yeah, Rich, the court's public trust and confidence really depends on, you know, the public's knowledge of what we do.
Right.
And so this, you know, we had great press coverage. This is an opportunity for us to get out of our so-called ivory tower and get down and you know, deal with important issues at the grassroots level. And so we love it.
Yeah, no, the more transparency the court can add to what it's doing, I think everyone is benefits from that.
I agree.
So, yeah. And, you know, the kids get to see... This is democracy in action.
Yeah.
Truly democracy in action.
Yeah, and it gives us a chance to, frankly, do some recruiting for kids to get interested in the legal profession.
Indeed.
We're worried about the baby boomer retirements and the, you know, the vacancies in certain areas of the law right now, particularly in rural Minnesota, and it's really important to kind of grow our own, I think, within every community. And so we had a number of questions from students about, you know, how do you go to law? How do you get to law school? What do you need to study? Yeah. What do you need to do? And so, yeah, it's kind of a recruiting effort, too.
When I graduated from high school in 1987, I was told, okay, I was thinking about law school, and I was told there were more lawyers in law school than there were lawyers on the planet, and was almost dissuaded from going to law school. That's not the case anymore, is it?
It's not. I mean, I started law school in the fall of 85 and heard sort of the same thing.
Yeah.
I mean, that, you know, it was...
Well, you seem to have come out okay with
it. Yeah, I guess so. It wasn't, you know, as we've talked before, my path to where I'm at right now was not exactly a traditional linear path,
right.
But it just goes to show you that there are different, you know, paths out there in the legal area. And I, you know, a number of my Carleton classmates went to law school and they're doing all sorts of different things. I mean, some of them aren't practicing law. Some of them are in firms. Some are, you know, in the legislatures. It's a gateway to a career is what it is. And for me, back in the mid 80s, you know, it was there. I think I hear what you're saying. I mean, there was some concern about, you know, is this a definite guarantee to an employable job?
Right.
And it, you know, then we had the recession in the late aughts, I guess, the 2007, 2009, where there was a lot of dysregulation with regard to the law profession. But the big demographic shift is the retirement of the baby boomers.
Yeah.
And so they are leaving and have been leaving in such numbers that, you know, there is absolutely going to be a need for more lawyers.
All right. Well, that kids, if you're listening, it's a good way to go.
It is, and particularly if you're willing to serve a, you know, underserved area.
And that's the thing. I mean, you get so many people who just think, oh, you want to be a lawyer because you want to make all kinds of money and stuff. But, you know, I there's the like a public defender, right? Or somebody who goes into, say, immigration law. And I don't know how much you can even comment on things like this. But there are a lot of facets of the legal profession that are not especially glamorous, but are really there to serve your community and serve the people around you.
Absolutely.
And that's, I mean, if you're really interested in giving back to society,
right,
it's a great way to go.
It absolutely is. And I've been in the so-called public sector most of my career.
Mm-hmm.
I want to emphasize that lawyers going into the public sector aren't doing it for the money.
Right.
I mean, you know, there is money to be made in law, but it's not being a public defender or a prosecutor or a, you know, legal aid lawyer. However, you're doing it for other reasons.
Yeah,
you're doing it for public service. And that's what I think gets and motivates a lot of people to go to law school to, you know, try to help others. And yeah, there is a lot of ways that you can do that as a lawyer.
And it's very easy to sort of fall in love with the law too, the philosophy of it and the way it's interpreted and the way it's crafted. I love to hear people in the legal profession talk about their love of the law, because that's the passion that I want to see in what anyone is doing.
Yeah, I mean, that's what gets us up and gets us going every day, to dive back into really challenging legal problems and try to come up with, you know, reasonable solutions to
them.
And that's a that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Also want to highlight that we have a new district court judge in Goodhue County that was just sworn in last Friday. Judge Tori Stewart joins Judges Bailey and Buren in Red Wing as of yesterday. Judge Stewart comes from the Dakota County Attorney's Office.
Okay.
I think she used to be a assistant Rice County attorney a number of years ago and has been working in the prosecutor's office in Hastings and took the bench and was sworn in last Friday. So a new member of our district court to welcome.
Well, congratulations to Judge Stewart and good luck to her.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah, she'll have good colleagues in Red Wing. I think having a few people in the building is always helpful when you're a new judge. And, you know, Goodhue's one of those counties that, a little bit like Rice, has, you know, rural dimensions and more exurban dimensions, you know. There's, you know, some challenges in managing a county like that. It's not a predictably, you know, rural or urban type of demographic.
Right, right. Something you could speak to a little bit.
Actually. I can, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I dealt with that. I was actually down in Worthington last Wednesday. I went off the local Dollars for Scholars Board, but they had their annual awards ceremony scholarship awards ceremony last Wednesday. So Jane and I went back, and I hadn't been back for a year, and it's just so familiar when you show up after having not been there for
a while.
It was wonderful to see friends. We had dinner with two couples that were really close friends of ours and gave away some money to deserving students. And
wonderful.
You know, the diversity of Worthington just on full display there. Yeah. And it's so good to see the academic aspects of high school being rewarded too. Oftentimes the athletes get a lot of the glory and the coverage in the paper, but it's fun to see young people shooting for the stars, so to speak, in terms of their academic education.
Yeah, that's great. Well, we are coming to the end of the legislative session, and they have both the House and Senate have now passed a public safety bill.
Yes.
That I believe the governor is going to sign in the next couple of days. And you and I have been talking over the last couple of days. There's a lot in that public safety bill, leaving out all of the new gun laws and parameters. But there's a lot in there just for the judiciary. And today, and we might have to talk about this again next month too, but today I wanted to ask you about clemency. Because there are changes now to the way the clemency process is going to work in Minnesota. Can you, Justice Moore, give us, tell us how the clemency system has worked, and then what's the process going to be moving forward? And I don't know if you're able to give any opinions on this or not, but you know, feel free.
Well, as you mentioned, Rich, this omnibus public safety bill is a big deal.
Yeah.
Big deal to the judiciary, big deal to our justice partners, law enforcement. I mean, there's so much in this bill. I was reviewing it again this morning. I mean, we could have a couple of episodes and probably not finish the discussion on them. But yeah, the clemency issue is a really important one. I think we should talk about it. And I will. I think it is a good caveat to note that the governor's not signed this bill yet, so it is not official.
Right.
Until it's signed, you know, nothing is a done deal. Yep. However, the fact that the conferees agreed on this, it was passed in both houses after it went through the conference committee, I think we consider this to be likely a finished product.
The governor has given no indication that he would veto this.
He has not. Yes. And I think particularly the clemency provision is something that I think his office was very much supporting. And so I would be very surprised to see any type of veto going into this. But so working back in the process, Rich, you might remember the Supreme Court had a case involving a challenge to how pardons are awarded or given in this state. Mm-hmm. Basically, clemency is a way to, you know, not necessarily forgive a person for their crime, but you know, the pardon process is a way to help people move forward with life, to unburden them from the conviction that they are suffering from. Usually it's related to something that happened a long, long time ago.
Yep.
Sometimes it's related to, you know, questions about, you know, actual guilt or innocence.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, those are things that we've talked about as well. The pardon process, though, has been criticized in Minnesota, and I'm not going to take any position on that. I'm mm-hmm. just going to tell you what the criticism was that led to this lawsuit that was brought. Currently, right now, the pardon board is comprised of the governor, the chief justice of our court, and the attorney general.
Yep.
And under the law, the way the legislature structured the pardon board, a unanimous vote of those three constitutional officers were required in order to grant anybody clemency, which a pardon is one type of clemency.
Sure.
And as a result of that, I think there has been a sense that the pardon process, the clemency process more broadly, has become very, very much backlogged and not as effective as it could be in terms of moving cases forward.
Okay.
The number of applications has risen, and the unanimity requirement on that, you know, frankly, led to fewer applications being granted than in surrounding states.
Okay.
In Wisconsin, for example, I think I saw some statistic that Governor Evers, who I think has exclusive authority in Wisconsin over a clemency, had granted almost like 800 applications for clemency. And, you know, our system was just putting out a fraction of that.
Sure.
And, you know, when there are disagreements between the three constitutional mm-hmm. officers, mm-hmm. strongly held, mm-hmm. legitimate, sincere differences. I'm not suggesting political differences. I'm not suggesting, you know, just posturing differences. These are difficult cases. I mean, you've got people convicted of very serious crimes oftentimes.
Right.
Not always. Sometimes right. it could be a minor deal.
Right.
But the ones that get in the news are the really hard cases involving people that have been accused of very serious offenses. Mm-hmm. And so you've got crime victim and family input, you have law enforcement input, you know, political input sometimes. And so I think it's been challenging on some of these cases for the pardon board to get to consensus. And so after a consideration of various options, the legislature has passed a law establishing a 9-member clemency review commission.
Okay.
To review applications and provide recommendations to the Board of Pardons.
Okay.
So this would be basically taking some of the work off the pardon board, because as has been pointed out, our pardon board here is comprised of, you know, three of the state's busiest leaders.
I was going to say, that's three busy, busy people.
Yeah. And I believe the pardon board met typically twice a year.
Sure.
And they were laborious calendars, you know. Mm. And so what this does is, you know, first of all, applications for clemency include pardons, commutations, and reprieves. And so right now, what has been established is this 9-member clemency commission, with each Board of Pardons member appointing 3 members. So the AG will appoint 3, the Chief Justice will appoint 3, and the Governor will appoint 3.
Interesting.
With full-time staff to provide administrative support for the process, conduct hearings, and provide recommendations to the board. The recommendation for this was based upon the fact that applications are increasing. The DOC expected that applications could double this year due to a greater awareness of clemency, resulting in 370 or more applications being considered annually. And so the bill is also intending to center equity by codifying accessibility provisions, requiring victim support and protection, and funding community outreach about clemency. And so clemency is going to be more accessible under this bill because the vote was changed. The threshold to grant clemency right now, as indicated, the Board of Pardons needs a unanimous vote to grant a pardon based on a statute that is over a century old.
Yeah.
And during this litigation that came before the court, I think it was pointed out accurately that Minnesota was the only state that required that type of unanimity between the members of its board.
Is that right?
And yeah. And the court found that that was not unconstitutional, by the way. I
okay.
mean, in the Schroeder case, not the Schroeder case, the our pardon board case, we found that the Constitution did not prohibit the legislature from establishing a unanimity requirement.
Okay.
But the Constitution also would allow a two-thirds vote, or two out of the three, as long as the governor was one of the people that was supporting the application for the pardon.
Mm-hmm.
And so now the voting requirement being set by the legislature will not require a unanimous vote. It will require the governor to be in support of a pardon.
Okay.
And so what this Clemency Review Commission will evaluate are 10 factors for a pardon or sentence. And a couple of the key ones are the nature, seriousness, circumstances, and age of the crime,
mm-hmm.
the successful completion or revocation of previous parole, probation, supervised release, the number, nature, and circumstances of other criminal convictions, the extent to which the applicant has demonstrated rehabilitation through post-conviction conduct, character, and reputation, and the extent to which the application has accepted responsibility, demonstrated remorse, and made restitution to victims.
And all so, acceptable criteria.
All totally appropriate criteria.
Yeah, absolutely.
And instead of these folks having to come to the pardon board and make these pitches, the work is going to be done by this pardon clemency commission that will take these applications and make recommendations to the pardon board. And the pardon board's recommendations will be in writing. They will recommend whether the board should conduct a hearing on a clemency application, and they have the right to summarily dismiss applications as well.
Okay.
All applications will be based on recorded votes, so there will be no secret process here. Everybody will know what's going on here. And the appointments to the commission, the legislature is encouraging the three members of the pardon board to appoint people with expertise in legal, correctional issues, victim services, correctional supervision, mental health, substance abuse. They want to address systemic disparities based on gender, race, and ability. And they want the commission generally to make solid recommendations on who should get a clemency. And sure. So clemency, as indicated, the board has the ability to pardon a criminal conviction. That means basically the conviction is taken away, to commute a criminal sentence imposed by a court to time served or a lesser sentence. So that's an existing sentence
mm-hmm.
with, you know, the conviction isn't being wiped off the books. It's not
right.
being excused. The sentence is being commuted. Or a reprieve can be...
Just so I'm clear, when you commute a sentence, you say, okay, you've served enough time.
Yes.
You can go home now.
Yes, exactly.
All right.
Or
all right.
you can reduce the sentence or say you've done enough time
okay.
served.
Yeah.
And so a pardon sets aside the conviction and purges the conviction from a criminal record. And so that is a complete, you know, absolute pardon. The pardon itself basically takes away the criminal conviction, and the person's not required
right.
to disclose it except in a judicial proceeding or during a peace officer licensing process. So the other forms of clemency are less final than that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the Clemency Review Commission here is an effort to try to streamline the process and get the three members of our pardon board out of the business of having to do a lot of this baseline work.
Sure. Sure. Because that would, like we say, I mean, you're talking about three of the highest, the three highest judicial officers in the state. And, their staff is pretty busy as it is, and to have to get them ready for even 2 days of pardon board a year, it's a lot.
Yeah. And, you know, just from what I've heard about this process, you know, how much time do these three members have to fully examine every applicant seeking clemency?
Yeah, absolutely.
This commission is going to do that work.
Okay.
It's sort of like the Judicial Selection Commission.
Okay.
You know, the governor
sure.
right now isn't out, you know, personally doing due diligence on candidates for judgeships.
He didn't sit in on a couple of your cases while you were
no he's got a staff
and
he's got the Judicial Selection Commission
right.
doing that due diligence
right.
For them. And so this makes, I think, frankly, a lot of sense.
And now, do you know, so the members of the board are are appointed by the three officers, the Chief Justice, the governor, and the AG. Will that change as we have new officers in
there?
Okay.
Yeah, I would assume it would, just like with the Judicial Selection Commission. When the governor's term starts, there's a newly constituted selection commission, like the Sentencing Guidelines Commission that I'm on right now.
Okay.
Yes, when you have a new appointing authority, there's new appointments made.
So these aren't lifetime appointees or six-year terms or something like that.
And I think there's really going to be a focus on victim services here. The staff of this commission will help victims prepare presentations and assist them in, you know, deciding what they want to tell the board about, you know, an application for clemency. That's a really important thing.
Yeah.
I mean, families deserve to be heard.
Yes.
And deserve to have assistance in getting heard. Judges and prosecutors, I mean, people who dealt with these folks at the trial level ought to be heard as well. I mean, as I sat in the district court, you know, I would hope I would be consulted regarding a case that I sat and watched, or somebody who I'd had numerous dealings with. You know, prosecutors and law enforcement, their opinion should be sought out too. So it should be a comprehensive review regarding the suitability of clemency. And, you know, it's my hope that most of these cases will be, even though unanimity isn't required, that with the work that's being done, hopefully the path forward will be pretty clear as to what should happen. So that's the Clemency Review Commission, Rich. That is effective August 1st of this year.
Okay.
And so they're going to have to create this new entity and make appointments.
So, but as I'm thinking about this, we're talking about the one thing I want to make sure I'm clear on this. What part of what this does is it gives the governor the ability to deny clemency, but if he wants to grant clemency, then he's going to need someone else to agree with him.
Yes, he has to be in the majority.
Okay.
But yes, the Attorney General and the Chief Justice could not grant clemency over the governor's objection.
Right.
Because of the way the Constitution is structured, the governor has certain powers that are constitutionally granted. And so the legislature has the authority to establish this pardon board and establish you know, the process, and that's what they're doing here. So
did the governor did not have the power to deny clemency previously, though, unilaterally?
The decision to grant had to be unanimous.
Okay.
So if there was anybody who was in disagreement with it, didn't matter.
Okay.
Could be the Chief Justice, the governor, or the Attorney General. If one of the three disagreed with the clemency application, it didn't move forward.
Okay.
And so, you know, I think, frankly, having a staff and having funding to do the due diligence and investigation on this, I would think is really going to improve the process here.
Okay, that's
great. Hopefully
will
answer the questions of the pardon
board.
Because a lot of times, from what I heard, there were questions about things, and the applications had to be sent back for more work, and it was, you know, a laborious, lengthy, difficult process.
And, you know, the longer it takes, the longer you're denying justice, possibly, to someone that deserves it. So,
On other news from the public safety omnibus bill, I just want to commend the legislature for addressing the funding issues that the legislature was asked to deal with relating to the courts, relating to justice partners.
Yeah.
And that was done in a really robust way this time. The legislature has provided basically full funding of the request for employee compensation increases, and the largest raises will go to our deserving staff, the people that are doing the rank and file work at the courthouse, our court reporters, our people who are involved with that. We have the most robust compensation increase that I can remember has been granted.
Was the number I saw $10 million?
I don't know what the specific number is, but that sounds about right. They are, you know, full disclosure here, this will increase judge salaries as well.
Sure.
Again, nobody applies to be a judge, you know, for the money.
Right.
That's not why you're doing it.
Right.
But I think
I would hope not.
Well, it shouldn't be. It absolutely shouldn't be.
Right.
But I think there's a danger as judge salaries fell behind more from, you know, always private sector, but even public sector.
Right.
When you've got assistant county attorneys appearing in court who make more than the district judge that's hearing the case, that's a concern.
Yep.
That's a real concern.
Yep.
And I think, you know, this is going to take a good step in the right direction, frankly. And, you know, we need to ensure that our courts have the most skilled and dedicated people we can have.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I know of judges who have left the branch for, you know, financial reasons. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people have their own reasons for retiring or from, you know, leaving a judgeship. But we want to recruit the best. We want to have... We want to have people that had private legal practice, and yeah. I know a number of judges that have given up partnerships and mm-hmm. law firms, you know, which, you know, would be a big change.
Tom Neville here in Northfield did that.
Tom did.
Yeah.
Yeah. Chuck Weber in Scott County, you know, Ned Wall in Hennepin County, Marty Fallon in Carver County, Dave Lutz in Dakota County. These judges were all members of, you know, law firms that mm-hmm. were, you know, doing important and challenging work, and you know, law firm compensation is just a lot different than public sector compensation. Indeed. Is. And so this goes in the right direction, Rich.
Good.
It really does. And importantly, too, there's significant funding for other court priorities, courtroom and technology enhancements. We asked for and received funding to help us address the major criminal case backlog, senior judge money among that. We got permanent funding to increase salaries for our district court law clerks. This has been a huge problem with judges, you know, not being able to recruit mm-hmm. talented people to become law clerks.
Yeah.
And so there's a market adjustment that's been added, and then the law clerks will also be receiving the percentage increase that the bill comes for. So that will bring the law clerk salary up significantly, which will be good. We're also getting one-time funding to help address the rising cost of mandated psychological services. These are competency evaluations for people in court, the so-called Rule 20 exams, mm-hmm. really important. We are getting money to sustain four recently established treatment courts in Minnesota, and also to sustain recent increases in contract interpreter payments as the number of cases requiring an interpreter increases as well.
Interesting.
Also, the conference committee agreement provides for $96.4 million in new biennial funding for the Board of Public Defense, representing enough funding for 206 new FTEs in the public defenders area. The public defenders have been underpaid, and frankly, it's you know, they're doing yeoman service oftentimes with caseloads and salaries that are just, you know, ridiculous.
They are doing constitutionally guaranteed work for people, and I have not seen it up close, but it just sort of feels like these are the people that we possibly take the most for granted in the judicial system.
Yeah, it's like a lot of things in life. Until you're in a situation where you need somebody like that, you mm-hmm. probably don't really may not be aware of how important they are.
Yeah, exactly.
And
you don't know how much you use your back until you hurt your back. It's the same thing.
And they don't, you know, public defenders don't get to decline cases. I mean, they're, as you say, this is a constitutional requirement that people in criminal cases that can't afford to hire their own lawyers be provided an attorney.
Yep.
And so they don't have the choice of saying, you know, sorry, my caseload is too high right now. I can't take on that criminal sexual conduct case. They have to take it on all the way through, up through appeals. We also are getting in this state $30.7 million in new biennial funding for civil legal services, and 85% increase in total funding. It's just huge. Those for civil legal aid, eviction, family, those are guardianship cases through our wonderful civil legal aid providers in this area. Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services probably has the majority of the counties. And we're also getting funding for the guardian ad litem board for the work that our guardian ad litems do. Mm-hmm. Those are appointed professionals in child protection cases, family court, and guardianship cases, where they can be lawyers, but they're not acting as lawyers. They're acting as advocates for the child or the protected person.
Sure.
And they're giving the court, you know, kind of the, you know, here's what my client's telling me about how this or how I see things going.
All right.
So, yeah, and there's a whole boat of other sentencing issues. I mean, there's a provision that we really need to talk about at some point regarding a review process for criminal liability for felony murder committed by accomplices. There's a concern by the legislature that accomplice liability has become too expansive. That's when you aid and abet somebody else's, you know, heinous act.
Yep.
And you have to prove right now that you knowingly were involved in that and intentionally aided, advised, hired counsel, etc. But now there's also going to be a requirement that the person be deemed a major participant in the underlying felony and acted with extreme indifference to human life.
Okay.
And so, you know, this is a complicated area. I haven't looked at this bill in particular, but it has, as I understand it, retroactive application, meaning that people who are who have been convicted may have an opportunity to have their convictions reviewed. And so stay tuned on that, how that's going
to
work.
I'm going to want to talk. I've got, there's a lot of stuff in here that I'm going to want to talk to you about. Probably over the summer.
Yeah.
And even more coming from the legislature, should, you know, and you can't comment on this at all, but should the legislature legalize cannabis? There is a strong part of that bill that is going to retroactively expunge, records of people who were convicted of certain marijuana, crimes. And once we have all of that in front of us, I'm going to want to ask you about that too.
Yeah. And then finally, a bunch of new crimes were passed here. Now carjacking is its standalone crime for reasons that are pretty obvious.
That was not?
It was not a defined crime. It was charged under other provisions.
Interesting.
Aggravated robbery or theft.
Okay.
There's a new crime for organized retail theft. Listeners may have heard about some of these rings of people going into stores and just creating chaos.
Yeah.
There's a new felony there. And then possession of stolen catalytic converters.
Oh.
Yes, Rich, I wanted to get on this. The catalytic converter crime, it is now, if you have one catalytic converter, you shouldn't have. It's a misdemeanor. Two is a gross misdemeanor. 3 to 10 is a 5-year felony. 11 to 70 is a 10-year felony. And over 70 catalytic converters that you're not supposed to have, felony with maximum of 20 years prison. So the legislature has spoken pretty sternly about this catalytic
converter. That is fantastic. I stand as an advocate for all those who are victims of catalytic converter theft, and I'm pleased to see this.
One of our workers at St. Paul had two catalytic converters taken off his F-150 at the same time. Apparently his truck had two of them. Yeah, and that's just, I mean, that just creates an incredible amount of difficulty for people.
It's a pain in the rear end.
Yeah, so the legislature, Rich, this legislative session, you've talked about this with Representative Purcell, and I know Jeff, I mean, it's really hard to keep up with what's been going on up there. It's been extraordinary.
Just been a furious pace up there, and they're going to keep it going straight through. You know, the House says that they're going to adjourn on Thursday. I think we all kind of chuckle about that, but straight through until Monday when they're constitutionally mandated to be done.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't talk today much about the gun issues, and then the whole, you know, legalized cannabis thing, that's a whole nother kid caboodle. Sports betting, I mean, there's a lot out there that's still out there kind of in consideration,
right,
let's put it that way.
Right.
And yeah, we'll have to just react as things come forward. Indeed. Obviously, things that are likely to become coming before the court, I can't really get into a lot of discussion on, but suffice to say that it has been an extraordinary legislative session. And, you know, we have an extraordinary budget surplus allowed for some of the spending. I think there's a bonding bill that hasn't been agreed upon yet, is my understanding. That's
exactly
out there.
Right.
There's a lot of needs in this state for deferred maintenance them.
What's really interesting is that all the conversation about that bonding bill has gone quiet. And now, generally, a bonding bill is the last thing that is voted on. But there's for a couple of weeks, there's been nothing on that binding bill. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens here.
Yeah.
With just a couple of minutes left, why don't you, what's going to happen now with the Supreme Court for the next month? Are you guys, how long are you guys going to be in session?
We have another month here. June is our last oral argument calendar, Rich. Okay. And we, you know, oftentimes June is kind of a wind down month with mm-hmm. only 1 week of arguments. But this year it's going to be pretty busy. We have 2 weeks of arguments, busier than usual, 12 cases. We've got six petitions for review cases, two attorney discipline cases, two first degree murder cases, and one appeal from the tax court and workers' compensation court of appeals. So those are happening starting in 2 weeks. I think one interesting case for people might be interested in Schneider versus Children's Healthcare that's being argued on June 5th. And the question there is, does the Minnesota law governing disclosure of health records permit those records to be disclosed without a patient's consent for fundraising purposes when the disclosure is arguably authorized by federal law, particularly the HIPAA mm-hmm. law? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, challenging issue regarding informed consent and patients' rights,
yeah.
that's coming up. You know, I would say a number of kind of standard criminal cases, the first degree murder cases. One is a petition for post-conviction relief and the other is direct appeal. So we're going to be busy through June. And today, actually, we receive our applications for the 24-25 law clerk term. So
oh,
we are
yeah.
going to start reviewing them. And then in June, we interview for, you know, the clerks that'll be not coming in this summer, but the summer after that.
Yeah.
The clerks that'll be coming in this summer will be graduating from law school soon. Mm-hmm. And then most of them will be sitting for the bar immediately. And then they get, I think, a grand total of like 48 hours off. And they start with us the first business day in August. So it's kind of like
great.
A medical residency. They start on a date certain. And then they end
yeah.
at the end of July. And it's always so hard to say goodbye to our law clerks
sure.
because they do such important work. And frankly, by the time June rolls around, they are hitting their stride.
Yeah.
And by necessity, because we are really pushing to try to get our cases out as much as we can. And that's what the work is going to be over the next few months
yeah.
is just grinding through pushing cases.
And just because you're not going to be hearing cases after, you know, for a couple of weeks in June, that doesn't mean that you get the summer off either.
Oh, no. Absolutely not. We're not like the U.S. Supreme Court when they stand up at the end of June usually and rise for the mm-hmm. end of their term, they are in recess until October
yeah.
and they don't work. I mean, they have to have their cases cleaned up
yes.
by the end of their term, end of June, and so they stopped hearing cases with the April sitting, I think. So they've got 3 months, I think, to work on getting things cleaned up. We continue to work over the summer. In fact, we took review on a termination of parental rights case that's going to be argued in July. It's a case involving some challenging due process questions for parents in termination of parental rights cases. And because of the urgency of those cases, the timelines mm-hmm. for hearing them are really sped up. So
yeah.
we do have a July case, actually. Normally, we don't hear any cases in July or August. Our first session starts after Labor Day.
Sure.
But yeah, we are working. I mean, it does tend to be a little bit of without the pressure of oral argument mm-hmm. preparation, the work of the court's a little different.
Mm-hmm.
Justices do try to work in a little time if they can, and usually in July
mm-hmm.
to try to, you know, take advantage of that. But yeah.
You get the 4th of July. We'll give you the weekend.
Well, yeah, I know. Right. Yeah, exactly. That's good. Call it good. So yeah, we stay pretty busy and are, you know, we're really trying to improve on our work. I mean, we're asking district courts to get rid of case backlogs and to improve on their work. Well, we got to be a little careful, you know,
right.
in the glass house we live in. So
yep.
we are really trying to push getting our opinions out faster. Our work is complex. Some of these cases with separate writings just inherently are going to take longer.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we're making some good strides in that direction. I also think our numbers are starting to tick up. This June calendar, I think, is an indication of where things are headed for next year.
Yeah.
And so, but yes, there's a lot going on, Rich. We had two of my favorite members of the Court of Appeals are retiring this summer, Judges Riley and Jessen, just two excellent judges and great public servants. They're hanging their robes up at the end of August, the end of the Court of Appeals term. And so there's two openings now for at-large members of the Court of Appeals. And then next year, Justice G. Barry Anderson on our court will reach mandatory retirement.
Oh.
And so, you know, there's going to be an opening at some point next year on our court.
Okay.
And so that's going to be a big change. As Justice Page is reportedly fond of saying, when you have a new member, you have a new court.
Yeah.
And so, you know, how everything shakes out is will be interesting to see there. But so that's the news, I guess, from the Supreme Court, Rich.
Well,
you know, we'll continue to have these conversations during the summer, and if you want to focus on any provision of that omnibus bill, let me know.
I'm looking forward to these conversations. And Justice Moore, I want to thank you. This was a marathon session today, and I want to thank you for the giving us the extra time today. We appreciate it.
No problem.
Folks, we will be back. We are here every third Monday of the month with Justice Gordon Moore of the Minnesota State Supreme Court on Legal Talk. And thanks for listening, folks. We'll talk to you again next month.
This has been Legal Talk with Minnesota Supreme Court Associate Justice Gordon Moore. If you have questions for Justice Moore or would like to suggest a topic for future conversations, email us at contact@kymnradio.net.